Good morning. I call the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 26th at 8:02 a.m. Members present are the full committee. Representative Kai Holland, Representative Mike Prox, Representative Gene Nelson, Representative Steve St. Clair, Representative Ireland Hall, my co-chair, Rebecca Himshoot.
Good morning.
And myself, co-chair, Donna Mears. Just a reminder, for all first thing in the morning, please silence your cell phones. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my aide, Talia Ames. Talia. And thanks to co-chair Himshoot's aide, Thatcher Brower. And before we get started, I'd also like to thank our recording secretary, Sophia Tenney, and helping us from the Juno LIO is Chloe Miller. So we've got two bills on our agenda today. First, we'll consider a committee substitute for House Bill 377, Public Records, Audio and Video Muni Costs, and then we will hear invited and public testimony. This is the bill's second hearing. And last, we will have a bill introduction and invited testimony for HB 379 Service Area Elections. This is the bill's first hearing. Both bills are sponsored by the House State Affairs Committee by request, and thank you very much for joining us this morning, Representative Carrick, who is on deck for both of these bills. First, we will take up House Bill 377 to consider a committee substitute. Co-Chair Himshoot, got a motion for me?
I do. I move that the Community and Regional Affairs Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 377, Work Order Number 34-LS1196-H, as a working document.
And I will object for the purposes of discussion. My staff, Talia Ames, will walk us through the summary of changes in the CS. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Talia Ames, staff to Co-Chair Mears. 377, the summary of changes. Section 1 adds electronic mail or email to the definition of public record. Section 2 adds review and redaction to the actual personnel costs in subsection J. And it also adds a subsection to AS40.25.110. Subsection K provides an exemption for the Department of Public Safety from the five-hour rule, which is established in subsection C. And then section 3, again, adds electronic mail or email to the definition of public record. And we do have someone on the line from DPS to talk about the public safety part of things. There are questions.
If there's questions, yes. So are there any questions before we adopt the CS?
No, ma'am.
Afterwards. All right, then I will remove my objection to adopting the CS as a working document. Are there any further objections? No. Seeing none, the CS has been adopted as a working document. Thank you. Representative Carrick, I understand you have more invited testimony, and let's hear from them before we open up public testimony. Did you want to say anything first?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Good morning, Community and Regional Affairs Committee. I'll just put myself on the record. Representative Ashley Carrick from West Fairbanks, and we can go to the invited testimony.
Excellent. So we've got three folks online. We've got Tom Chard, attorney for the City of Fairbanks, Ron Duby, the police chief for the City of Fairbanks, and Nell Andreasen, the executive director for Alaska Municipal League, who is here in the room with us. So are we starting with Mr. Chard?
Sure. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for – oh, not on the line yet. It helps if I look at all of my notes and things available to us. So let's go to our police chief in Fairbanks, Chief DP. Please join us and provide your testimony.
Yes, good morning. This is Ron Duby in Fairbanks, Chief of Police. I'm just calling in again. Really don't have any more testimony than what we provided last time. I know we did provide some follow-up information to Representative Carrick with some of the questions that were asked last time and just some better answers for those questions. And I'm open to any questions that any member may have now.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for the chief?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mears. And perhaps this is a question for you or the sponsor. The additional follow-up information, I just was looking at my notes from the meeting we had last time about processing time, how many, and so on. And is that information in our packets or on basis that I could follow up with that? Or otherwise, I might ask the questions to summarize what was sent in.
I apologize, Representative Holland. I was trying to catch up with some other things. Could you repeat that for me?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chief Doobie mentioned that he had sent in some information following up on the questions from our last hearing, and I just was looking at my notes on those questions. I don't remember seeing the response from the chief in the packet information. I'm wondering if we do have that, if it's on basis, or perhaps I might ask him to summarize it. So I'm just trying to not take too much time on this if it's already there and available, and I just overlooked it.
Don't believe yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay Staff, Representative Carrick, Representative Holland, I got that information last night, and I'll distribute it to the committee members after the hearing. It's quite thorough, so it should have answers to a lot of the questions.
That's great. Nothing further for now, then. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us, Chief. So let me see here. Mr. Andreasen, do you have anything to add to our discussion today? Welcome back to House Community and Regional Affairs.
Thank you. For the record, Nils Andreasen, I'll say something I don't know about to add, but again, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, representing local governments across Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of HB 377. At its core, 377 is about maintaining transparency while ensuring fairness and sustainability in how public records requests are handled at the local level. Local governments strongly support public access to records. That's not the question. The challenge is that the current system is no longer aligned with how records are requested and produced today. Under current law, municipalities must provide up to 5 hours of staff time per requester per month at no cost. In practice, that requirement has created a structural imbalance. We are seeing a sharp increase in volume and complexity of requests, particularly for audio and video records of police departments, the rise of commercial and bulk requesters, often outside Alaska, submitting large-scale or automated requests, significant diversion of limited staff capacity in small communities. As AML members have noted, these requests can impede delivery of court services and shift costs onto local taxpayers. Clerks and municipal staff are on the front lines of this issue every day. The Alaska Association of Municipal Clerks has clearly stated that responding to modern records requests, especially digital and video, requires additional technical resources and staff time at taxpayer expense. HB 377 takes a straightforward and reasonable step. It allows municipalities to recover actual personnel costs for searching, reviewing, copying, and redacting records. It maintains existing safeguards. Fees are limited to actual costs. There's the ability to waive or reduce fees in the public interest. Continued requirement for reasonable access. This is not about limiting access. It's about ending an unfunded mandate and aligning cost responsibility with usage. This bill directly aligns with AML Resolution 2020-301, which calls for legislative changes to address the burden of commercial and blanket public records requests, recognize the growing impact of national data firms and automated requests, provide tools so local governments are not overwhelmed by high volume, low public benefit requests. Many other states in the federal government already distinguish between individual requesters, media, commercial users. Alaska currently does not. HB 377 is an important step in that direction. Right now, a small number of high-volume requesters can consume disproportionate public resources, often at no cost to them. That means a resident requesting a simple document is subsidizing a commercial entity requesting large data sets. HB 377 restores balance by ensuring that extraordinary use does not come at the expense of the general public. HB 377 strikes a necessary balance. It preserves transparency, maintains public access protections, and ensures taxpayers are not subsidizing disproportionate or commercial use. Most importantly, it gives local governments the ability to continue providing timely and effective responses to their citizens without compromising their core responsibilities. We appreciate the sponsor's work and the committee's consideration, and we encourage adoption of HB 377. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen, and that resolution from the AML is in our packets. So I wanted to thank Representative Carrick and her staff for being open to the inclusion of the Department of Public Safety. That was exactly some information we had from them in committee earlier this year about providing documentation on – thank you, Mr. Andreessen providing documentation that was being used for commercial purposes, other places, and why we are here today on both of those counts. So that is our list of invited testimony, but we do have a couple of folks online from the Department of Public Safety for questions. We have the communication Austin McDaniel, the communications manager for the Department of Public Safety online, and we can ask them about how many queries they get. And then we also have Nathan Teal, an analyst with Ledge Finance, that can answer any questions about adding money to the state government from those requests in this change. So let's Austin McDaniel, could you please put yourself on the record and let us know how many requests Department of Public Safety is getting that we should have some concerns about.
And Chairman, so when we get a chance, I wanted to go back to Mr. Andreas, and I had some follow-up we didn't get to.
I apologize. I missed that.
No worries.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Austin McDaniel. I'm the Communications Director for the Alaska Department of Public Safety. Part of my portfolio includes managing our response to Alaska Public Records Act requests. Chair Mears, in fiscal year 2025, the team of four people we have that manage audio and requests, so there'll be body-worn camera, in-car video, audio recordings, any type of digital media, received 720 requests. And that could be for, you know, imagine a response to a domestic violence call anywhere in Alaska would likely involve at least two troopers, both recording body-worn camera as well as a potentially in-car video. So a single request could end up with, you know, 6-7 hours of video between video from their vehicles, video from each other body-worn cameras, and it takes, you know, about 2 hours to redact a single hour of body-worn camera or in-car video.
So, Mr. McDaniel, that's about two a day, so that sounds like a couple of full-time jobs.
Chair Mears, Austin McDaniel, again, from BPS. We have four folks that work in our mobile audio video recording team. They have essentially three journey level staff as well as one supervisor, and they certainly stay busy working all of those requests. I will say the majority of the requests we get for all of our Public Records Act requests, so whether that's a request for a copy of a collision report or it's, again, body-worn camera video, are typically made from somebody directly involved in that incident, right? We do get probably between 10 and 20% that are from outside, people from outside Alaska, you know, the YouTubers, people that are not involved, media. But the vast majority of requests we get are from parties or the representatives of people directly involved in the call for service, at least at BPS. In fiscal year 2025, we collected $34,450 in electronic services and products fees associated with our requests for body-worn camera and in-car video requests. We charge a fee of $36.49 per request for audio or video request to the department. We do not charge any type of fee for standard requests for like a single police report or anything that will take less than 5 hours, of course, to locate and copy those records.
Thank you very much. We've got a couple of questions from community members. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Chair Mears, and through the chair to Ms. McDonald. Just a couple follow-up questions, please. I think just backing up from where we just were, as I understand the service fee for audio and visual, that fee, it sounds like, is charged just straight out for each request without consideration of how long the video is. We had earlier discussions about stuff over 5 hours was getting charged, and stuff under 5 hours was free. But this sounds like you're charging this fee for just any request for audio and video, regardless of length. Is that correct? And if a request is for something much larger, is there some sort of differential for larger requests?
Thank you for the question to the chair, Representative Holland, and Austin McDaniel for DPS again. So kind of based on the state of Alaska's interpretation of the 2005 Fuller v. City of Homer litigation that occurred, this state typically doesn't charge any type of hourly fee for redacting and reviewing public records requests. And that is consistent with how we handle things at DPS. We can charge fees for going and searching and copying. In kind of the modern era here, it does not take us long to locate any kind of recent record. Occasionally, we will get requests that are very large and voluminous that will include multiple years and does require staff to spend a lot of time searching for the records, or might be historical records where we have to go back to microfilm, microfiche to find the records. Then we might go over that 5 hours per requester. DPS doesn't charge a fee for staff time to review and redact body-worn camera video or any of our records, just consistent with the Fuller decision and the way the Public Records Act is written today. So we do charge a electronics product and service fee, which is kind of allowed in AS40.25.115. And that's the fee is calculated every calendar year. And we use that because there's three pieces of software the department has to purchase to make audio and video public records available to the public. We have a piece of software that allows us to do the redactions. We have another piece of software that allows us to securely transmit these records back to the requester. Another piece of software we use to apply redactions and convert media. So we go through and take the cost of those three pieces of software every calendar year and divide that out equally amongst everybody that's requesting audio and video records to recoup that money, which is deposited back into the general fund, as DPS does not have a receipt authority to retain any of the fees that we charge for our Public Records Act requests.
Thank you. Follow-up. Thank you. Thank you for that. That was really illuminating. Just one follow-up on this. One of the discussions we had at our last hearing with another jurisdiction identified that there was a significant amount of cost and, effort and time being put into processing the requests, getting a high volume, particularly requests that were coming in for material that were then kind of negotiated down to get the request under 5 hours. Are you seeing that sort of volume of requests for material and this negotiation of scope going on, or I'm wondering if this kind of flat fee per request is perhaps tamping that down and limiting that? But is there a lot of time and effort in just the quoting request process, or are you getting a pretty straight up request for material and you process it and you're done?
Thank you for the question through the chair, Representative Holland. Again, Austin McDaniel for DPS. We certainly have, I would say, less than a half dozen requesters that are kind of these perpetual, we'll call them YouTubers or media representatives that request a significant volume of body-worn camera and in-car video recordings that are likely uploaded onto a variety of social media channels and monetized. We try to work out kind of informal arrangements with these folks to make sure that we're able to still provide the service that's required under the Alaska Public Records Act in a timely manner for them, and then they help us out by doing some of the basic level research before putting in the request, checking to make sure court cases are closed in court view, going through and seeing what the outcome of those are, because they generally know what our rules are for releasing things and what type of records we're going to privilege. And that working relationship with kind of those half dozen requesters has reduced our workload. And then we're certainly prioritizing, you know, when we have high volume, we have a significant number of requests, we're going to always prioritize requests from Alaskans that are impacted by, you know, a state trooper's actions, whether they're a victim of a crime, a witness, they need something for their insurance claim. That's always going to move to the top of our priority list to make sure we're taking care of the Alaskans that are putting in requests.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. He stole my questions.
With fresh questions, Co-Chair Hemshoot.
Thank you. It's a quick question for Officer McDaniel. The 10 to 20%, it wouldn't have been that long ago, decade or two, where you would not have even had that, I assume, this YouTuber. You said half dozen or so. Has that number been growing, or is this something that, with the advent of YouTube, it's not always that, it's not like frequent flyers where it's the same people over and over again, which it sounds like it is the same people over and over again, but has that number changed in the last year, or is it a slow growth thing? I'm just trying to predict 10 years from now, instead of a half dozen of these, are you going to have dozens of these? So any indication of the growth of that sector of the requests? Through the chair.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Through the chair, again, Austin McDaniel for DPS. So we're seeing that number increase. I think the new Alaska State Trooper show on A&E is fueling some of that. I think the popularity of some of the original YouTube requesters we got is increasing that. It's not increasing at an unsustainable rate right now. I will say, you know, a few years ago when we began the Department of Public Safety's body-worn camera program, and we did foresee this, we came forward and asked for these four positions as part of the program. And on top of that, we also added in some of those specialized pieces of software, which allow us to really review and do the redactions necessary to protect privacy, confidential tactics, techniques, and other things required by state law in a pretty expeditious manner. Through some machine learning and AI tools that software has. So we're right now in a good place at DPS to be able to manage those requests. And of course, you know, I have no idea what the future is going to hold, but we're in a good place now to be able to continue to provide the, you know, responsive records within 10 days of the records being available.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just going to point out you said something like four personnel added to deal with these requests. Our municipalities do not have that, or at least not the ones I serve. I have 21 communities, and I know in Sitka this falls to the regular clerk staff. So we're taking care of our troopers more or less as the whatever governing body funder, whereas I can see this burden on municipalities being immense, and that's where we're not providing the staff. So we need to, I think, be really thoughtful about that. And so I do have another question for Mr. Andreasen when he comes back up. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, let's see, I believe you said 34,000 in receipts and about 30, you're charging $36 per request. And then you're sending the receipts back to the general fund. I can kind of see some benefit in giving the department receipt authority. Is that of any use to you? So that you can keep track of what it costs for that program.
Representative Prox, we also have Nathan Teal on the line from Ledge Finance. That might be a more, would you like to direct it?
Somebody, yeah.
To Ledge Finance?
That'd be fine, sure.
Thank you. Mr. Teal, welcome to House Community and Regional Affairs. Can you enlighten us a little bit about funds going to DPS versus the general fund and where we can make use of them. So that's an appropriate characterization, Representative Fox.
Absolutely. Good morning. For the record, this is Nathan Peel with Legislative Finance. Currently, the positions in DPS are paid for with general funds. So you could give DPS GFPR authority, which would give them additional funding available, but I couldn't tell you what the department would do with that extra funding. Alternatively, you could do a fund swap, which would be to take away general funds and give them GFPR instead of that, and force them to collect those receipts in order to pay for those positions. I bet the department, if I could go out on a limb, would prefer to just pay those positions with general funds and lapse those receipts into the general fund.
Follow-up?
Representative Prox?
Yes. Was the $34,000, did I copy that number right, that the department is collecting $34,000 in receipts for these requests? I guess that would be the total volume of legitimate requests and entertainment requests.
Through the chair, I believe the number was approximately that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And then, different question. Through the chair, has the department received any privacy complaints?
I believe that would be for Officer McDaniel.
Yes. Or Officer Dupree, either one.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, could you restate your question, please? This is Austin for DPS.
Yes, thank you. I'm just wondering if there has been any complaints about violations of privacy. I would think there would be at least some exposure to that, especially in the video.
Thank you for the question, through the chair. Again, Austin McDaniel for DPS. We've certainly received some feedback from people. It's actually typically been in Alaska Wildlife Trooper contacts and people that are hunting and fishing kind of out in a public space. We've gotten, the sportsman that's unhappy that maybe their secret fishing or hunting spot was uncloaked through a Public Records Act request when their, ticket that they got was released. That would I would state is kind of the complaints we've gotten for, maybe not redacting enough. We're pretty progressive in how we look at redactions with kind of an effort and a policy call from the commissioner to give out the maximum amount of information about the Alaska State Troopers that we can without jeopardizing our investigations, without violating state law, of course, and without violating anyone involved's privacy. Of course, I could request that we have law enforcement officers in somebody's home where there's children present. We're investigating, high-level felonies, maybe a sex crime. Those types of offenses would, of course, have a lot more redaction, a lot more privacy considerations than, something that's happening out in the open, out in public, in a place where somebody would have less of an expectation of privacy.
I appreciate that, Officer McDaniel, and I think that's a warning to folks that if you do have a secret spot where you go to hunt or fish, make sure it's legal, and if it is legal, act legally there. Chief Dupree, do you have anything to add on privacy concerns?
This is Chief Dupree. I would follow up with similar to what Austin said, we do get people that are, upset sometimes when public records are released. We released a video yesterday of a fatality DUI, and, we're getting messages now from the suspect's family or the defendant's family, they're not happy that we posted the video online. We get the same thing when we release records and they go to one of these companies and it's put on YouTube. But for the most part, it's just the fact that, you know, those cases are coming to light, not necessarily anything that was done in the redaction. We don't deal with the Fish and Wildlife issues inside the city of Fairbanks, and we as well do, we tend to side on the cautionary end when we redact stuff. So when we go into the hospital, if somebody requests something from one of our officers that's gone through the hospital, the entire video is blurred out. There's nothing that's, you know, nothing that's seen there. The only thing that they get is really the audio. Likewise, if we go to domestic violence in somebody's house, a lot of that stuff is blurred out. And so we do our best to accommodate that, but we're never going to be able to please everyone.
Thank you very much, Chief. And I imagine these are all very... It's always emotional when someone's got a unexpected interaction with law enforcement, so I can imagine that it brings back some emotions. Representative Prox, do you have a follow-up?
No, I think that's enough, and I'm not sure whether it's worth delving into that further for this particular bill, so I'll be happy now.
I appreciate that, Representative Prox. Are there any further questions for folks online before we bring Mr. Andreasen back? We've got two in the queue for him. Mr. Andreasen, can you please rejoin us? Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Andreasen. I wanted to go back to this discussion about fees, and we had discussed it at the last hearing. And I understand the general intent around the collection of money is not to turn this into a big revenue center and get rich off of selling this material. So the current language of the bill is pretty tight in terms of just getting direct burdened labor costs. That being said, what we heard last time was that there's a significant amount of time going into the processing of requests, providing quotes. Folks come back and say, you know, get it back under 5 hours. They requote it, and they're never recouping any money from that whole process. So I wanted to go back to you to see if you had any thoughts on how we might think about the municipal activity of providing these quotes and responses. You know, it was actually quite illuminating what we just discussed in terms of public safety does have an application fee. And I don't think right now we have that lined out in terms of what we were doing with the statute. And so that's kind of new information that's helpful. And I guess where I'm going for the moment is, are there models that you've seen within our municipal governments for how we appropriately handle fees for requests, whether it's through utilities, for bills, for property records, something that might give us a model to understand how to capture the activity cost of getting high volumes of requests and potentially differentiating that from casual daily requests that we just want to provide as a public service. A property owner wants to get their property record. We probably don't want to be dinging them a bunch of money to do that. But on the other hand, this commercialization of our public information, is there any guidance you have or any examples or models you've seen in our municipal governments that might give us some perspective?
Again, for the record, Neil Sandreasen, Alaska Municipal League, through the chair to Representative Holland. I'm trying to restrain myself with all the things that I would like to say about this situation. I think I should stick to an answer to your question. I don't know of local governments who currently have the ability to do what they need to capture the costs that go into fulfilling these requests. And they're right now restricted by statute and be able to actually do that. And I think more broadly, we shouldn't be thinking about, I don't think about this as a revenue stream for local governments. Right now, the Alaska taxpayer is subsidizing commercial activity across the nation, not even in Alaska's best interest or public interest. We are straight up using public local taxpayer dollars to fund YouTubers elsewhere across the world. And I don't understand why that's okay. So at the very least, remove the five-hour rule. Let us charge what it actually costs. I think Sorry, I guess I wasn't able to restrain myself. I think the other side of this is we're not able to do the job we're supposed to do because we're fulfilling requests from outside interests. And we have clerks who spend most of their day responding to commercial requests for data from data mining companies. Do you want clerks and local governments to manage elections, to process water and sewer needs or landfill applications? Do you want local governments to adjudicate public safety or deliver public education or fulfill commercial requests? I think that's the heart of the question here. And the $34,000 that DPS is able to recoup for four staff being able to meet these needs is ridiculous, right? So we should just think about this as our subsidy, Alaska taxpayer subsidy of others, and not in necessarily the public interest. So we need a better way to differentiate. When is this for Alaskans? When is this in the public interest, in Alaska's interest? And when isn't it? And at the very least, removing the five-hour rule does that.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. It sounds like as we go forward, there may be more work to do. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Andreessen really covered it, but I just wanted to also add to Representative Holland's question that really at the heart of this bill, we're just allowing municipalities to perform this function for charging. It doesn't require them to do that. And one thing just in talking to city clerks in preparation for this bill is that there's already a process above the 5 hours for clerks to waive fees. They frequently do it. You know, if you do get that kind of one-off situation, they recognize that, and they, in their professional practice, often see that as different than these commercial requesters. And so I think this legislation is providing that latitude for them to make those decisions for the under 5 hour. And I think if we're trusting them to make those decisions about waiving fees for over 5 hours, it's more of a political question here. Is that something we're comfortable allowing municipalities to have the latitude to do rather than just a strict, are we charging or not charging? The legislation's just providing that option.
Thank you, Representative Carrick.
That was good for now. Thank
Any
you.
Further? Okay. Representative Hemshire.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I'm going to read two whereases from the AML resolution for Mr. Andreessen. Whereas the U.S. Office of Management and Budget established fee guidelines for the Freedom of Information Act that establishes a distinct commercial use requester fee category for these requests, which establishes fees for public records requests by those who seek records for, quote, a use or purpose that furthers the commercial trade or profit interests of the requester, unquote, and whereas the OMB fee guidelines could be used as a framework for local governments and state agencies to be adequately compensated for work provided to commercial data firms, if the Alaska Public Records Act were amended to allow this. So my question to you is, if it were in statute that local municipalities could make a determination of the purpose of the request, if that were in our Public Records Act, would that benefit local municipalities, and would it burden them in that there could be court challenges to, oh, this is not for, like, how would they make that distinction? Mm-hmm. So you've got it in a resolution, so I'm taking it very seriously, especially since we're looking at that act right now. So my question is this, are there unintended outcomes if we were to do something like this?
Sure. Representative Hemshute, through the chair. Would it benefit local governments? Yes. I think it would increase it would increase local decision-making authority when it comes to these. Would it be more work? Potentially, which comes with local decision-making. There would then be added a layer, and this is part of that choice they would make. And whether they were, if the statute allowed, whether they would enact it similarly. Would they go through a prioritization process and develop a determination process for what is public and what is commercial? And there are standards around the nation that are pretty well developed to mitigate some of the risk or liability that could come from that. And AML would support local governments in working through those issues and provide and help develop some standards to alleviate or mitigate some of that risk. But at the end of the day, there will always be some risk in how to challenge that. I think it was important to hear from Department of Public Safety. They're very clear, like, we know who YouTube requests come from, and we have a working relationship with them so that it's not as onerous as it might otherwise be. And I think that's what you would get to, is you would know which companies, which requests are coming from non-Alaska locations or requesters. You would be able to determine their business activity and whether, for instance, do they have a business license in Alaska to be requesting this. You could go through a process that helps to mitigate that risk and evaluate that and avoid, I think, some of the litigation potential that's out there. But
follow up. Thanks. Through the co-chair. So I want to be really clear. What this would do is not say that you can deny. Rather, you can charge more. You can have a variable rate that you charge for someone who's requesting for commercial purposes. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Himshut, I think that's right. I think the other thing I kind of heard throughout is a prioritization process that local governments need to place, you know, first and foremost residents and kind of work through. So residents, public access, and then commercial requests. So I think that's part of it. It's not just a tiered and pricing system. It's how do we make sure we can do our job and put people in our communities first, since they're paying for this service, and then beyond that, what can we do?
Follow up,
Representative Himshut.
Thanks. Do we have anybody from Ledge Legal? So this whole idea that you can treat people differently is always a a concern, and so the prioritization. Yes, we're going to get to you, but you're a lower level. Is that equal treatment? And so, if the OMB is issuing the guidelines, then in theory, this stands up to scrutiny. Or you, in your testimony earlier, you said other states have addressed this in state statute. So we're not going into shaky ground with this conversation, right? We don't have Ledge Legal, do we?
We I can follow don't, up. But Representative Himshut, I think this is something we're talking about local governments making those decisions, mm-hmm. and not something that they're taking into consideration rather than what we're doing with the statute. Representative Carrick?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would maybe suggest directing that question to Tom Chard, who's the Fairbanks City Attorney, if he's available. I also just wanted to note for committee members that, again, just as a reminder, in this legislation, we're only talking about charging up to the actual cost of production.
So
and
far.
So far. I just think that that's important to note. We're talking about creating a tiered system. We're not talking about municipalities charging exorbitant rates for production of content. We're talking about up to a maximum of the actual cost to produce.
And quick follow-up.
Coach Himshut.
And it's more just a comment. And what I'm thinking about is we still only will ever have one clerk and a part-time clerk in Sitka, and their time, you know, even if they're allowed to charge, it's sort of the question that Mr. Andreessen posed. And so I'm taking yet another deeper look at this legislation. So thank you for bringing it to our attention, and we'll talk more later.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, do you still remember your question?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just some comments before the question, and I don't know if it'll be for the bill sponsor necessarily, but I really like the may and shall language. They may require the requester to pay the municipality's actual costs, and then if they determine that that needs to happen, then it shall be paid before the work is done. Definitely also agree that $34,000 does not pay for people's salaries in Alaska. So, like, that's just kind of icing on the cake. I think that looking at the statute, once again, I agree with eliminating, frankly, the five-hour limitation. And looking at that, this is what I wanted to check, is Section 40.25.110, C says, if the production of records for one requester in a calendar month exceeds five person hours, the public agency shall require blah, blah, blah. But then it goes to Section D, and it says a public agency may reduce or waive a fee when the public agency determines that the reduction of a waiver is in the public interest. So I don't know how that would work, but if we change the language in C, D would still be in effect, where the person, like the people who are in that local municipality, can determine for themselves, and that's very broad if it's in the public interest. So I think what we want to do is we want to protect people who, even if they're bringing a case against the state and they need that information, we want to protect their ability to get that information. Somebody's in Florida running a YouTube channel that's never been to Alaska. We want to make sure that the work that those people are doing that is actually taking away from the work of the people in that local community, that they pay for that. So I guess it's a question and the process and all that. I don't know if you want to dive into that to the bill sponsor on eliminating the 5-hour, because I think Section D would still protect the things we actually care about, where it says that it may be removed. That's kind of my thought process leading up to the question, and I don't want to open a can of worms necessarily, but I think that would be the easiest way to resolve this, is just to trust the people that live in those communities who are getting the request to make the determination if it is in the public interest. And that's a very broad term.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. And they're doing that already, but I'm sure Representative Carrick's got more to add.
Great.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Co-Chair to Representative Nelson. Just wanted to add two thoughts. One, this legislation just adds another exemption to the 5-hour rule, so it's not eliminating the 5-hour rule. I think if the committee wanted to consider just eliminating the 5-hour rule, that's a very much broader policy conversation and maybe gets outside of the scope of this legislation. But in terms of creating the same language structure that exists for over 5 hours, where it says shall and then it has a may waive, I don't see a reason. I'd have to look into it more, but I don't see a reason to be opposed to that for this legislation, to sort of change the language so that there's a required fee that may be waived, as opposed to what's currently happening in this legislation, where we're simply giving a more latitude to municipalities to have discretion about making those decisions. The one thing I would note is public records include a lot more than just production of audio and video material and redaction. And there's a lot of this that is really simple to provide. We heard that from the police chief, Ron Dupuis. There's not really a time cost involved in sending over, say, a report communication that's already prepared. So the one thing about utilizing that language as the default that you've mentioned, as opposed to what's in the bill, is would we then be requiring, with shall language, a default cost to be produced by that municipality that they wouldn't currently have to produce because they would just be providing it. So I think that's one thing to consider about how we structure the language in this bill.
Mr. Relay, do you have more to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff Representative Carrick. To Representative Nelson's question about the 5-hour rule, I would note that when we were originally drafting the language for this bill, we explored that, but after conversations with legal, per a court case, which is the I don't remember the exact court case name, but it's been referenced once or twice relating to the city of Homer from 2005, the 5-hour rule came out of that court case, just an outright repeal or removal of the 5-hour rule would add additional complications.
Representative
Nelson.
Yeah, I recognize that it was, probably opening a can of worms, but I also recognize that there are any kind of rule, there's people that are going to manipulate it to their own advantage. And so just trying to make it to where, once again, the people that are closest to the people in the community can make those decisions. That's my goal. So I'll pull off from that. It definitely sounds like you guys are ahead of the curve and it needs more work, but that I would like to see that, and I think that the statute would provide adequate protections, barring a court case, which sounds like there's already one. I'll check it out. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two comments. One, I'm looking forward to Mr. Relay's email having the responses. That's why I haven't asked a lot of questions, because I sent him a whole bunch. So I want to see what the responses are on that. And additionally, I share the concern that Representative Hemshute had with the 14th Amendment equal protection under the law if we do some type of prioritization. I think we'd be okay, but I'm going to get clarification on that. This is good legislation. The question is are we going to unify in statute a fee schedule, power that down to the municipalities? There's a couple of questions that are still outstanding. But again, waiting on Mr. Relay's email with the answer to, like I said, I had like eight questions that I sent him.
Thank you, Mr. Relay.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mears, for the record. Stuart Relay, staff to Representative Carrick. Representative St. Clair, we are working on answers, and I apologize for not having those in advance of this hearing. That was my intent after our last hearing, and then time just flies by when you're having fun, I guess.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, and it looks like our committee aides will see if we can get that to us while we are in the room, because our next bill will have Representative Carrick and Mr. Relay in front of us. But we also have public testimony. Do we have any further questions? We do have someone online for public testimony. All right. We are solid for a minute. You are out of the hot seat for a minute, folks, and we will get to our public testimony. So, do we have anyone in the room? Oh, I got to open it first. I'll now open public testimony for House Bill 377. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? No one in person, but on the phone we have Ed Martin. Mr. Martin, please put yourself on record and provide your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair. The topic, first off, my name is Ed Martin, Jr. I'm 71 years old. I'm an Alaska resident for over 60 years. I've done a lot of freedom of information requests. House Bill 377 appears to be a knee-jerk reaction, probably from the YouTubers. Not surprising. We're seeing a lot of abuse in our government today. And quite often, public records comes into transparency, accountability, and justice. Article 1 gives rights to the press. And a lot of you folks need to maybe understand that there's another branch of government, in a sense, and it's we the people. Yes, we elect you, your representatives. You're supposed to do for the best of the people and create laws that are not arbitrary and capricious. I can tell you right now that I know several cases of which are in the court under discoveries, under a lot of situations in which this is a very complicated and messy ordeal you're going through right now because it costs public money. But I can tell you, if we're going to get to a point where justice accountability is the cost of just what it costs for it, we're losing it in this country. We're losing it. Justice should not come at a cost. It should come at what the society accepts and doing things proper and under the law. Now, I can go on and on. I only have 2 minutes. But one thing I do want to say, Kai, you got a great bolo tie. I love it. And for the rest of you, God bless you on the mission that you're trying to balance. But commercial people should really, to some degree, pay for what they want. The rest of the citizens, it's probably for the betterment that we get the Alaska Public Records Act in conformity to what is fair. So I'll let you guys go. Thank you very much. I may be the only one calling in today.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Martin, and indeed you are. Are you up for taking a question from Representative Prox?
Or a comment? Through the chair, I just want to make a comment. I was thinking of Mr. Martin as we were discussing this, and he is... I appreciate how aggressive he is about transparency and trying to do things right. And this is kind of an example of the, I don't know, I won't say dilemma, but the balance we're trying to make. But he sometimes gives me more work than I can accomplish, but I really appreciate his calls. So thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And with that, we do not have anyone else online for public testimony, so I will close it. I'm going to set House Bill 377 aside, and we'll take a brief at ease as we peruse these questions and answers and get ready for our next presentation from Representative Carrick and Mr. Relay. Good morning. We are back on the record in House Community and Regional Affairs. Are we ready?
Yes.
We're ready. Here we go. So next we'll take up House Bill 379 for introduction and invited testimony. Representative Carrick, Mr. Relay, please put yourself on the record again and begin the presentation.
Thank you so much, Co-Chair Mears. And again, good morning to the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. I'm really pleased to present on behalf and by request of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, House Bill 379 this morning, which allows for service area flexibility and local control. I have a brief intro statement, and then I would turn it over to my staff for a quick sectional, and then we do have our Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor to provide a presentation on this issue. House Bill 379 is a targeted common sense update to Alaska law that governs borough service areas. It's designed to address real-world challenges that prevent local governments from efficiently delivering essential services, in this case particularly road maintenance, to the residents who need them. Under current statute, which is AS29.35.450, changes to service areas, including annexation or boundary adjustments, often require multiple layers of voter approval, even in situations where the change is just administrative, where it's necessary for public safety, or where it's clearly supported by the affected community. While voter input is critical, these requirements can create unintended barriers that leave some Alaskans without access to basic services. In large boroughs like the Fairbanks North Star Borough, these barriers have resulted in roads and subdivisions that cannot be incorporated into existing service areas, even when those roads rely on the service area for access. As a result, some residents receive no road maintenance or construction services at all, and HB 379 helps correct this by allowing boroughs to align service area boundaries with practical realities of infrastructure and access. Importantly, House Bill 379 preserves voter approval as the default rule for major changes to service areas. It also provides prospective flexibility for service areas created after the effective date, July 1st of 2026, which ensures that future growth is not constrained by outdated statutory requirements while avoiding disruption to existing service areas. This forward-looking approach respects current arrangements while giving boroughs the tools they need to plan effectively for the future, which is something really important. It's been very difficult to figure out a way to juxtapose the desire from many in communities to not have a new process for road service areas while figuring out a way to not have a continuing and growing problem going forward. At its core, this legislation reinforces a principle of maximum local self-government embedded in the Constitution. Locally elected assemblies are best positioned to understand the community's needs and design service areas that will work for residents. HB 379 empowers local decision makers to act responsibly and transparently while still maintaining appropriate public safeguards. This is a balanced and pragmatic reform, protecting voter rights where they matter most, removing barriers where they do not, and essentially ensuring that Alaskans receive basic services that they can depend on. And I just would also note for the committee members that part of the reason that Fairbanks and Starborough is front and center today is because we do have the vast majority of road service areas in the state of Alaska, but this is a statewide issue. There are road service areas in the Mat-Su, in Kenai, and elsewhere, and just wanted to make note of that. But I think Fairbanks is probably the best location to illustrate where this problem has arisen. And at this point, I would ask my staff to just walk us through the very short sectional on this bill before we turn it over to Mayor Hopkins in Fairbanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff representative Carrick. This is, although this is a three-page bill, it's only its changes are fairly modest. Section 1 of the bill adds a new subsection to AS 2935-450, and that new subsection gives second-class boroughs the power to abolish, replace, or alter service areas created after the effective date of this act, and it establishes the effective date of July 1, 2026. That, Madam Chair, is a sectional analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Relay. So, Mayor Hopkins, welcome back to Capitol Room 124, although virtually this time. You're in person last time I chatted with you here. Good morning, and please tell us about the road service area conundrum and how we're going to fix
it. Certainly will do. Oh, thank you, Co-Chair. It is not nearly as good to be not there and by phone instead. So thank you for allowing me to call in and not have to fly down. But it's a beautiful spring day here in Fairbanks, and I hear it was cold and windy and far snowier there. So I'll stick to my Fairbanks roots. And thank you again for hearing House Bill 379 today. And as Representative Carrick said, it is we are front and center when it comes to what's road service area issues and things like that. So the biggest thing about this bill that I want to start off with is it does not impact any of our current 103 road service areas currently in existence today. What it does is it creates a prospective look and an easier way for road service areas to be created going into the future. We have struggled in recent years, actually said the past 22 years, really on trying to create and bring in new neighborhoods who want to tax themselves to get road service. Currently, we have of our 103 road service areas, they cover about two-thirds of the total local roads in our borough. The rest are, you know, the city of Fairbanks is a home rule municipality, so it has road power, so everything within the city of Fairbanks and the city of North Pole maintain their own roads and are taxed themselves for it. We, of course, have state roads covering many of our major roads and connector roads, and the state maintains those. But many of the feeder roads that and neighborhood roads are local roads. And if you are not in the road service area, you have to maintain those through just a system of volunteers patching up their own potholes and plowing their driveway and their roads throughout the winter. Sometimes neighborhoods are able to collect their own little pass the hat sort of process for funding that. Sometimes it's just a good Samaritan. But many of our neighborhoods have tried to vote themselves into service areas, and current state law requires that both the neighborhood wanting to go into the service area vote to do that, and the service area accepting that new neighborhood also have to vote to accept that service area. So it takes two groups to both say yes. And sometimes one of them says no, quite often. And in fact, only about 40% of these votes have been successful over these last 20 years. Sometimes it's the one wanting to get themselves service that says no. Sometimes it is the one that is accepting the new service area that says no. But what is important as we look forward to try to solve this problem with House Bill 379 is it does not impact any of the current service areas. So many of them that have come to like the service that they provide, enjoy their neighborhood feeling and how they maintain their services, does not change that at all. So this is only a prospective forward-looking bill, allowing us the flexibility to come up with our own local solution instead of having to continuously come back to the legislature and say, hey, we need one more fix, because as a second-class borough, we need state and legislative approval to do many of the things that we want to do. And as a second-class borough, it's a wonderful route that we have, but it certainly can be limiting when specific state law does not allow us the flexibility that we need. So all this bill does is allow us to start being more flexible by creating and altering service areas coming up in the future. We have some plans and some ideas about how what our local solution could look like through local ordinance, and I can get into that if anybody's interested, but it's not what the plan is at this point. So let me go ahead and start with the PowerPoint slide. As I said, is it up on the screen? It is, fantastic. So that second slide there. Like I said, the biggest conundrum we've got is trying to get, and that we're trying to fix, is getting neighborhoods the service that they want to tax themselves, and we're running into obstacles with that. Road service areas and second-class boroughs are how we get maintenance and a tax base to fund many of our roads. Fairbanks has 103 of them. Mattsview has something like 8. Kenai has a few of them. And Ketchikan and other second-class boroughs also have several of them. But we have the vast majority of them. And as you can see in the slide there, in the 1980s, we had an astronomical jump in the number of road service areas. The reason we had that was the state was funding service areas on a per-mile basis. So every service area wanted to create their own taxing jurisdiction and say, hey, I can get a grant from the state based on how many miles in my road. And it worked well for when we had funding that flowed like oil, but now we don't to the same extent. So we're not getting those funds from the state anymore to help support the creation of new road service areas. We also have 103 and don't want 206 of them. We don't want to double the number to create new service areas. We want to find ways to create a system that can start consolidating new areas. You know, the good thing about road service areas is it keeps the control at the most local level, and that's one of the reasons we have 103 of them and 5 fire service areas and 1 lighting service area and a utility area. So it keeps that local control there at the neighborhood level, and that's a wonderful system that our community has come to enjoy. But it can be unwieldy to manage 103 or more of them. It can be very difficult to consolidate them because you have to have both sides voting yes, and it can be very difficult to create new ones. And the growth of the road service areas has largely stopped, as you see, going into the 2000s. Next slide, please. I'll assume it is up. I'm about a minute behind on the video. Existing road service areas tend to be disinclined often to allow new service area parcels to join. And this is not often a financial decision that road service areas make. So, for example, we just had one where it's a very long established road service area called Our Service Area, O-U-R, because they like their service area. It's called Our Service Area, and there was another area that was discontinuous, so it was a few miles down the road, that was a dense service area that had a very high property value per mile, meaning they would have been an efficient use of dollars to go into that existing service area. But Our Service Area, the existing one, voted no to accepting what was called College Hills neighborhood or College Acres neighborhood because they liked the system that they have. They would have gotten more money per mile to be able to do the maintenance and do the work to plow and fix their potholes, but they like the system that they have. So they voted no, even though it would have been a financial benefit to them. So we see many different reasons that people don't accept new service areas. And so you can see the number there on the side that how many of them fail because the existing road service area said no or the annexing road service area said no. And it's certainly a mixed bag. 40% of them fail. 40%, only about 40% of them pass overall. And so it's a rough system that we have. Actually, by math, it's actually worse than 40%. Between 1972 and 2004, like I said before, the state shared revenue to help maintain more roads. And it was a good system at the time. But in 2004, new legislation passed. Making it so that you have to have those two votes in place, and it
created a harder system. I think that was what passed in 2004. Our attorney can correct me on that if I'm wrong. But, you know, so what we're – so if I can go on to the next slide, slide four. All right. So this is a map of our road service areas. You can see it is absolutely a patchwork of where the roads are maintained and where they're not. Many of the connections are state roads. Many of them are federal highways. But in the neighborhoods, there's much denser population around the Fairbanks North Star Borough than what you see in that area. And the reason we cannot just start creating new service areas is there's constitutional language in the Alaskan Constitution that says, essentially, if a current existing service area can provide the service, then you should not create a new service area just because it would be an easy task. So that's the reason we have not been able to create new ones. We've been looking to combine new ones into currently existing service areas. More areas do want service. We have a chart that I didn't share with the committee that goes down the winners and losers of all of the different elections, 49 elections over the past 20 years, and it's a mixed bag of them. So we're trying to solve this problem going forward. Continuing to add road service areas piecemeal won't fix the problem. It's hard through the Constitution as well as incredibly difficult to administer. What we do for road maintenance is we have each road service area contracts out their maintenance. They're piling with, you know, a number of companies in town with plow trucks and graders and front end loaders, a number of, you know, companies with the equipment to be able to fix the potholes and the drainage issues. But there's only so many of them. And as more and more service areas come online, those are stretched thin, as we certainly saw in our very snowy winter this past year. Elections to consolidate road service areas would also be costly in labor and municipal dollars that we have to spend for every road service area to hold the new election. So they're expensive, they're difficult to apply. We don't have enough contractors in town to continue to add them as well. So next slide, please. The benefits of this proposed law change, it creates a system more easily where we can get service to people who want to tax themselves and provide it currently struggling to join existing service areas. You know, we will never, ever start mandating changes to a service area under my watch as mayor without elections at the local area. And so that would still be required. We would still be holding those elections locally. If somebody wants to create a service area, the majority of people in that neighborhood say yes. But we have hopes of being able to create regional service areas so that people can start joining into those as they vote themselves in. This would allow changes in that service area without requiring that second vote of new service areas created starting in July 1 of 2026. Like I said, as a prospective look forward, it does not impact current service areas that are in existence. Representative Prox on there might be familiar with the Assembly's Road Service Area Commission Board. It's our local board that oversees the different road service areas. And when I went and presented this idea to them and this resolution that the Borough Assembly passed in support of this bill, the one thing they were most concerned about was not impacting current service areas and the systems that they have in place. And it does not do that, only new ones going forward. But the most important thing also is it doesn't come asking, the Fairbanks, North Star Borough, and other second-class boroughs will not have to continue to come forward asking for piecemeal solutions by the Alaska State Legislature. It allows us to come up with local solutions at the local level that we can understand what's going to be our best options for fixing this conundrum we've got and provide more service to people who want it and not to those that don't. And so with that, that is my presentation. There are the attorney is also online from the Fairbanks North Star Borough to answer additional questions that I am not able to. So with that, I pass it back to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we, as Mayor Hopkins mentioned, we do have Jill Dolan on, who's the attorney for Fairbanks North Star Borough. Ms. Dolan, do you have testimony to add, or are you just here for questions?
Hi, thank you. I do not have testimony to add. I'm just available for questions.
Excellent. You seem to be pitched as the answer for our questions. So do we have any questions from the committee at this time for Fairbanks? Senator Holland.
Great, thanks. I think for the moment I just want to address two questions. I've got a lot of questions. We have a lot of road service areas in Anchorage, and particularly in House District 9, most of the area is covered by a patchwork of these road service areas, and we have many issues with people trying to get into road service areas. We have gaps in the road service areas. We have unintended problems because we add to road service areas, but we don't have any mechanism for funding of the middle mile roads that connect them to the main road. So it's not an issue without a lot of complexity. For the moment, two things I want to clarify. One is, if I read the language on page 3-7 being added, it's not clear to me that this is providing a way to create the new road service areas. But I think I understand it probably has to go back to a vote. But the thing that's confusing me at the moment is that it seems like the problem is we have too many road service areas. But it appears the way the statute is written that none of this is going to apply to the existing road service area. So we've got to create a bunch more in order to have ones created after the date in order to have these new powers. So it seems like it's a bit of a paradox that we're trying to deal with too many. But to deal with too many, we've got to create more. And I just wonder if you can help me understand what seems like a paradox. And in doing that, I'm also curious, does the process of creating ones after this date, so you have more powers, does that allow you to create new ones that can overlap with the existing ones that then give you later some powers to do some combination and consolidation work? So that's kind of my first question at the moment, is just help me understand the paradox. And I think you see why I'm asking this.
Probably. Madam Co-Chair, if I could just briefly respond and then turn it to Jill Dolan, to Representative Holland. Just to answer maybe the political component of that question, one of the biggest challenges that we've seen is this juxtaposition between those in Fairbanks who proudly live in a place where you have the right to not have your roads plowed and the actual desire for services. You know, that only goes so far as the time when you need an ambulance, and then all of a sudden having a road service area and consistent service becomes very important to you. So just on the political component of that question, you know, the borough looked really hard into, and I know this has been an outstanding problem for a long time, looked really hard into finding a way to not affect the current system while not creating more of a problem going forward. And there's probably a number of ways to do that, but it's been a very difficult balance to strike, and this legislation attempts to do that. Previous bill drafts, I'm not sure if there was introduced legislation, Mayor Hopkins could probably speak to that, but previous attempts to do this have affected existing road service areas and been roundly criticized in the community. So that's definitely been a political challenge. But in terms of the technical aspects of your question, I think Jill Dolan's probably a better resource.
Thank you, Ms. Dolan.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions, Representative Holland. Again, this is Jill Dolan. I'm the borough attorney in Fairbanks North Star Borough. Through the chair, to Representative Holland's first question on that not being a clear way to create new service areas and us having too many service areas, that is true that the legislation doesn't directly address that. There is a constitutional requirement that we first determine whether or not a service can be created or can be provided by an existing service area. And that is always the first step in determining if an annexation can occur, if the service can be provided. We have in the past tried to get legislation in order to be able to consolidate road service areas, and we've been unsuccessful in that legislation. The most recent on that was, I believe it was SB 105 in 2021, that Senator Myers sponsored, and there was a lot of opposition to that. And so what this would really do, to create a new service area, there's a separate provision in Title 29 that still requires an election. So if a new service area was created, it would allow us to annex into that without the two-vote requirement, both the parent service area and the area to be annexed. So it would limit elections and make it a determination more of the governing body to determine whether or not it was appropriate to annex an area. We do have a process currently where we do an analysis when we're determining whether or not a new service area or annexation can occur. We look at everything from taxable assessed value of parcels to tax revenue that would be generated, as well as things like the operational costs of the new area, the road conditions, lengths, materials, things like that. So we do try to balance that at the local level. The second question you asked was if they were created after this date, if we could essentially assume a new service area of an old service area. I'm sorry if I'm paraphrasing there, but we would not be able to. We still would not be able to combine or alter a service area that had been created before that July 1st, 2026 date. So existing service areas really would be parked where they are. The double election requirement would still apply to those. So this would be just for the new service areas that were being created.
Thank you very much. Mayor Hopkins, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. I'll take a stab at question number one, Representative Holland. We would have to create new service areas to provide new service. But our plan and our idea would be to do it in a controlled fashion that creates regional service areas that people would be able to join in a neighborhood. So that Assembly Road Service Area Commission that I was talking about before, the big one that oversees all of the small road service areas, there are broken into six different regions across the borough. We can create one regional service area. We can create six regional service areas as long as we can find a path through that would allow for the Constitution. And by doing that, we would then create a system where new neighborhoods could join. So we would create a set number to be able to provide the service to the neighborhoods that want it. Instead of if 100 new neighborhoods wanted to get themselves service, we don't need to create 100 new road service areas. We would be able to, ahead of time, create a certain number that is low in volume and easily administratable and can get contractors to manage it, and then have new neighborhoods join it. That's our hope, what we're looking for going forward in a nutshell. So yes, but in a controlled fashion to get the most people service at the lowest cost that they want when they want.
Thank you,
follow up. Yeah, thank you. That explanation is really helpful. I think I'm getting a clearer understanding of this. The other question I wanted to ask is that from my interactions with the road service areas, one of the underlying challenges is that they're run by volunteers that put in a tremendous amount of work running their local LRSA board and overseeing the contractor, and in many cases still being the primary person calling out the contractor and deciding what work to do what morning and getting up at 4 a.m. to go drive the roads to figure out should they come out or not. And I'm wondering, in looking at this legislation, if there's been any thought around these new service areas changing anything that allows the actual service area board staffing to be done a little differently so that it's not as onerous on the boards. Because, I know in the case of ours, the reason they didn't want to annex new areas is the volunteers are already burned out from doing what they're doing and can't take on any more work to add another neighborhood in there. They're not getting paid to do what they're doing anyway, and it's a thankless job because the only time you call your road board is when you've got a problem. So I'm wondering if you've got a different model of these new service areas you're creating. Can they be structured in a way that is a little more friendly to the volunteers that we maybe are asking to oversee and do the day-to-day work that keeps these things functioning.
So that's probably for Mayor Hopkins.
Mr. Holland, certainly you're not wrong. It is often a thankless job because people don't call, like you said, unless there's a problem. Elected officials, many of you have a similar conundrum as well, but, you know, we get stopped more in the grocery store for the good work and good votes and good action we take than many of these people, for sure. You don't get called when your neighbor, you don't get thanked when your mailbox does not get knocked over. So, you know, the current process and system that we have now can be onerous, but many of our good Samaritan volunteers on these boards love it. And that's one of the reasons we have not seen a lot of annexations successful and expansions, because they love their neighborhood and they want to continue to work on it. And that's totally understandable. If we do move forward with the regional model I was describing, it would be something we would look at for those specific new ones going forward. But again, this bill is only prospective and does not impact current road service areas in second class boroughs, only ones going forward, and would allow us to tweak that model if that's what the borough assembly sees best.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have more questions for Fairbanks? Coach Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. This is for Mayor Hopkins, and I'm just going to go ahead and display my ignorance here, but I come from a place where there's no such thing as an RSA, so I'm learning. My question is, why do places choose to be a second-class borough? What is the history of that decision? And I know Mr. Andreessen's in the room, and he's probably rolling his eyes, but Mayor Hopkins, why is it a second-class borough? What is the advantage? Why did people want to be a second-class borough?
Co-Chair Hemshoot, it is the way we created ourselves nearly 60 years ago at this point. You know, I was reading early when I was first elected the story of the creation of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and it was fraught with a lot of concerns about, you know, overtaxation, government overreach, concerns about property rights, and also just additional taxes, and making sure that what the new government that was going into place at the time provided was what the community wanted and needed. And to strike that balance, the second-class borough allowed that to happen because new powers can only be added by a vote of the people or as a legislative bill. And so knowing that you're always going to have the will of the people at the forefront for what is happening and what powers that the community has was attractive to the community at the time. For a historical knowledge of other municipalities and why they went second-class borough, I would have to hand it off to Mr. Andreessen. Many, of course, have combined and changed from a second-class borough to a unified municipality, like the city and borough of Juneau or Anchorage, for example, and a number of others. So,
quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And Mayor Hopkins, when you have these elections, is it just on the regular annual municipal ballot, or are these special elections that you're having to pay for because it's such a small area impacted? Does that go on the general election ballot?
Co-Chair Hemshoot, no, they are special elections only available for that small service area. We've had zero people show up for elections. We've had four people show up for elections, and we are actually just closed a number of them. The borough assembly has to take a vote to allow that service area to hold that vote to change their boundaries, to change their tax rate that they tax themselves at, and all those things. So they're special elections, and that's why they're low turnout and high cost.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
It feels ironic that to have less government, you have more government, because you have to have the borough decide and then you have to have an election. And okay, so then my final question really was related to that cost. Is it a local decision then to not just put those questions on the annual ballot? I guess the problem then is you would have people not from that area facing that question, and it doesn't apply to them. So you really do have to hold a special election for each of these.
I don't actually know the question to that, or the answer to that question. Ms. Dolan, do you know if it's a state requirement or a local requirement?
Hey there, this is Jill Dolan through the chair. So it is, it's not a state requirement, but the state does not do precinct boundaries for our road service areas. And so the precinct boundaries don't follow the same boundaries for our regular election. So it's logistically difficult to have those available on our regular election day. We do have a set date for service area elections, but we do them all through absentee voting because it's difficult to determine if someone is a resident of a road service area without going through that process because we don't have the precinct information from the state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. With that, I think we're ready to have Mr. Andreasen come and give us some additional context. And I'd like to acknowledge the patience and attention of your executive assistant with you today.
He's so bored.
Let's make it exciting, then.
Yeah. I asked him if he wanted to testify. Thanks for the record, Nils Andreasen, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. I do have some prepared remarks, but there's a few things that maybe I want to comment on. So it sounds like from the committee discussion, there are lots of potential problem statements when it comes to service areas. This bill is trying to solve for one of them, right? So I think that's important. There's lots of approaches you could we could take to addressing this, but it starts unraveling pretty quickly all the historic effort that went into getting us to where we're here, at right now. So I think that's worth noting. You could unravel it too much and not get to dealing with the problem I think that the bill is trying to get to. I think the second thing that I would note is it's interesting from Mayor Hopkins' presentation that this was originally the state's fault, and most things are. But I think in this context, community revenue sharing was originally designed based on the powers that were adopted at the local level. It was based on how many police officers did you have and how many road miles did you plow and did you take up education. During the period that he referenced, community revenue sharing, as it was known then, was $180 million that went out to communities. It's $30 million today. And when it was ended in 2004, in 2000, the state was broke. And so it went through, there was no community revenue sharing or assistance for a few years. It came back in additional years in different formations. It was $90 million in its original conception that went out to communities as community assistance just over 8 years ago. And today is $30 million. So you can see that over time, one, it wasn't tied anymore to the services being delivered by local governments and residents, and it's diminished, which creates this real challenge at the local level to deal with some of the consequences of that buildup and then the lack of support on the other side. So I think that's worth noting. I shouldn't maybe comment on to home rule or not to home rule. But I think you know, it's worth you knowing that the reason you're talking about service areas in this context is because, like we've talked about before, there are home rule governments in second class. They're general law. They can only do what you allow them to do. And they have to have it in statute, your direction, to enable them to address this issue as a second class borough. I think there's a perception that a second class borough is a more form, a limited form of government. I can also point to home rule boroughs that are the most limited form of government, who only do the requirements that are that are there for them, and don't do more. So I think that's been a perception, and probably historically. I think there's also, and I think you know, in the case of Fairbanks, you've got a home rule city surrounded by a second class borough. There's not an example, and I don't know a good statutory approach to having a home rule borough on top of or around a home rule city. So it could be because of that relationship then between the home rule city and the borough at large. So I think that's part of it. To it, at its core, this bill addresses a practical but important barrier in how boroughs deliver essential services like roads, fire protection. Under current law, even when residents are willing to organize, tax themselves, and meet service standards, they can be prevented from joining or forming a service area because of existing approval requirements. This creates a structural barrier to local decision-making and can lock in inefficiencies over time. The answer in this case is to increase the number of service areas, even though that's also the problem, a different problem statement. HB 379 introduces a more flexible framework, particularly for second-class boroughs in this case, by allowing service areas created after July 1st, 2026 to be altered, consolidated, replaced, without requiring separate approval from each existing service area. Importantly, this bill does not remove local control. It preserves the fundamental principle that voters approve changes affecting them. What it does is remove unnecessary procedural barriers that can prevent willing communities from acting in their own best interest. From AML's perspective, this bill aligns strongly with three of our core principles: local control and self-determination. Communities have the ability to decide how they receive and pay for services. HB 379 respects this by maintaining voter approval while ensuring that one area cannot indefinitely block another's ability to organize. Efficiency and cost effectiveness. Alaska already faces high service delivery costs, particularly in rural and geographically large boroughs. Fragmented service areas can lead to duplication, inconsistent standards, and higher long-term costs. This bill creates a pathway for consolidation and more efficient service delivery without requiring it or doing it right away. Three, there's practical governance for second-class boroughs. This bill recognizes the limits of administrative capacity, providing tools to address inactive or non-functioning service areas and to better align service boundaries with actual use and access. We appreciate that the bill includes targeted provisions addressing real-world issues, allowing adjustments when parcels rely on roads maintained by a service area when service areas are inactive. These are pragmatic fixes that reduce liability and improve service reliability. HB 379 is a thoughtful step toward modernizing how boroughs organize and deliver services. It reduces unnecessary barriers, supports local decision-making, and creates opportunities for more efficient and responsive governance. We appreciate, again, the sponsor's work on this issue and encourage the legislature to advance the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chair Hemshute.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, all of this kind of makes my head spin. So there are five of these boroughs: Fairbanks, Matsu, Kenai, Kodiak, and Ketchikan. How do the others feel about this? Are you able to speak on their behalf, Mr. Andreessen? Has there been communication, or is that should we be concerned about that? If we solve a problem for one, are we solving the same problem for the others? Do they see this as a problem, and creating a problem?
Yeah, through the chair, I haven't heard that other boroughs are resistant to this at all. And for those that we have checked in with, they've been supportive. But we can do some additional work to determine whether other boroughs have strong feelings.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm having a hard time maintaining my composure.
I know the feeling.
I guess we'll get exciting now.
The graph that is no longer up there with the spike in the 1980s.
Slide two.
This is very much a Fairbanks North Star borough problem. Mm-hmm. And it is a huge problem within the borough, very divisive issue. Well, we'll just get into the different perspectives. Looking at the graphs on slide two, or the graph on slide two, would you agree that it was that the state subsidy does not align with the constitutional provision of maximum local control? And we'll have a difference of opinion on that. But go ahead. I want to have your opinion first.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I want to make sure I answer it correctly, or at least from my understanding. I think when we're talking about maximum local self-government, I had a conversation with Vic Fisher many years ago about what that meant. And it seemed like for the founders, that was really about geographic extent, as well as much local control as possible. I think from your question, I don't view the state subsidy as differing from or unconstitutional at all. It enabled greater local self-governance for lots of little parcels. And I don't know how to reconcile kind of geographic extent with the formation of 103 service areas. But also, that's a very legal and technical question that's probably outside of my realm.
Hey, follow up.
Representative Fox.
Has the AML or the bill sponsor looked at other ways? I guess where I'm going is, from my perspective, A, the Fairbanks North Star Borough was not formed because the citizens within the Fairbanks North Star Borough wanted it. It was imposed by the
Mandatory Borough Act. Yeah.
Right. And maximum, what do they call it, maximum local control, maximum self-government is if you want something, you ought to be willing to pay for it. And if you don't want something, you should be free to not pay for it. That's maybe an extreme position. I get it. But have you looked at the unintended consequences of local statutes that impose more requirements on boroughs or on road service areas, and how that might inhibit the functioning of those road services and the desire for those road services areas?
I can jump in. Thank you, Co-Chair Mears, through the chair to Representative Prox. I don't think it's going to fully answer that question, but I would note a couple of things. One is, this legislation is trying to provide a better option going forward. And I think that's really important, because how we've done it has not been great. You know, there was an unintended talking about unintended consequences. There's the unintended consequence of the existing model, wherein little roads like mine are not in a service area. We have no opportunity to join a service area. If my neighbor at the end of the road were to suddenly move or pass away, I don't know how my road would get plowed. I don't know how that would happen. I think that's the situation so many people face currently. And then another current conundrum is, if I was in a road service area and there was an election in that service area, and I was here in Juneau, I'm not sure how the road service area would contact me about that election. These special elections are expensive. It's hard to get a hold of people. The Fairbanks North Star Borough is the geographic size of New Jersey. So you're talking about people in pretty far-flung regions of that borough, and trying to communicate with these residents, you know, Representative Prox understands the challenges in our borough more than anybody. But I know it doesn't fully answer your question. The reason I decided to put forward this legislation is because the way we've done it is clearly had unintended consequences, and it clearly has been problematic. I believe that this legislation strikes a better balance about how we move forward.
And I really do appreciate the good intent behind this. But quite a few years ago, and I could be wrong about this, but the our service area was mentioned as a case in point. I believe the total mileage is half a mile or something like that. And on the other hand, it's a really tight little neighborhood. They asked to form a half-mile-long service area, and they all agreed to it a long time ago, and it's just a really good organizing method. It's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go out and talk to your neighbors. And quite a few years ago, there was a big discussion at the borough. I believe Ms. Dolan is familiar with that, about restricting what the service area commissioners could do because of liability concerns. And I'm pretty sure that the our service area testified against imposing those liabilities because the commissioners, I think the whole neighborhood must have been on the commission, but they enjoyed going out, grabbing their chainsaw and cutting down the willows and what have you. And I just really think it's, I just really appreciated their testimony. And I think that's what we really need to do. The service area concept, if we follow it and tell people what you're asking the borough to do when you form a service area, if you don't have unanimous consent, is you're asking the borough to tax somebody else so that you can get the service you want. And that is the fundamental problem we have with government.
We got a
gosh. And, well, I don't know.
Where are we going with our discussion here, Representative Prox?
I guess where we're going.
We got a few minutes left here.
This is so important to me. I might drop everything else I'm doing to oppose it, and I don't want to do that. But I think that's what we really need. If we're going to act as the state legislative body that's going to impose our will totally against the concept of maximum local control, we owe it to those people who are going to be appropriated into these service areas. Because it is, as Mr. Andreessen pointed out, in my opinion, it has been state interference first in creating an unrealistic expectation of the state funds it. You form a lobbying organization. You don't form a service area. And that has created lots of problems. And we really need to reach out to those folks that vote no and ask them, well, why did you vote no? Because I've never lived in a service area, and my neighbors wanted to form one. And I said, nope, I'm happy to go buy a grader and be the service area commissioner and the maintenance contractor and the whole nine yards. But nope, I don't want anything to do with service area. Because then we would have to spend, oh, goodness, several hundred thousand dollars to bring the road up to the artificially imposed standards to maintain a service area. It's a huge, difficult, fundamental problem of the way we look at the responsibility of government. And I'd be happy, more than happy, to work on this through the summer. I just hate to spend all the time we're going to have, or I would have to spend on this bill this year.
So I'll take that as a comment more than a question, Representative Hinshute.
Yeah, a question. I apologize.
Nelson, oh, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In the last 2 months, I've gotten more of a education on the Fairbanks road system from talking to Representative Prox than I ever understood. It's an incredible amount of history and complexity. So, and definitely echo his sentiments as well. And I think it was Benjamin Franklin that talked about legislating money out of somebody else's pocket. Mm-hmm. But the question that I have, it's been referenced a couple times, and even in the sponsor statement. So I guess this might be a question for the sponsor or maybe Mr. Andreessen. It talks about the number of road service areas, 103, 102, whatever it is, in the Fairbanks area, the most by far. In second-class boroughs, which this would apply to, and I'm going to be following up with the Matsu borough as well, but how many, like when it says the most by far, what's the total number of road service areas that would be affected by this legislation that this is the most by far?
Through the co-chair to Representative Nelson, I believe, I don't want to get out of turn here, but I believe there's about half as many remaining on all the rest of those communities. So 103 Fairbanks, somewhere around 50 to 60 total with all the others combined. But we'll confirm that number and get back to you.
Yeah, it's good enough for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hemshoot?
Thank you. Through the chair, again, I come from a place where we don't have road service areas, so I need to understand if you need emergency services. If your place is on fire, who puts out that fire? I just need a basic understanding of what a road service area is and how it works.
So through the co-chair to the co-chair, Representative Hemshoot, we can have Jill Dolan or Mayor Hopkins also elaborate here, but we have 5 fire service areas in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and so the closest one to you that's able to respond will respond. One of the challenges with road service areas and not road service areas is if you're in a road service area, like Representative Prock said, the downside is there are certain standards that one has to meet to maintain that road service area. If you're not in a road service area, like myself, and it snows really hard overnight, and my neighbor, again, if he's on vacation or he's unavailable, my road doesn't get plowed. So if there's an emergency on my road, and the fire department cannot respond, they would be walking up the road a different direction. There are real public safety challenges to not being in a road service area currently. And in terms of just how general response works across the borough, I think Mayor Hopkins would probably be better suited to respond.
So quick follow-up. And maybe this is for Mayor Hopkins, but you're not denied the service, but then how is the service paid for? You pay out of pocket if you, and Rep. Prox can speak to this maybe, but if you have an ambulance call to your home, they're not going to not come. But if you're not, maybe this doesn't apply to ambulances. I'm lost. Sorry.
I think I understand the question now. Through the co-chair to co-chair Hemshoot, the fire service areas apply regardless. Life and safety is applied across the borough, so you don't have to be in a road service area to receive service area provisions for basic fire and medical service.
So how's it paid for then?
Maybe it's the Representative Fox.
Fire service areas are different than road service areas. And so if you happen to be in a fire service area, the fire trucks will make an attempt to get there. There is quite a bit of territory outside of the fire service areas. And so Two Rivers as a case in point. They're, what, maybe 20 miles beyond the boundary of the nearest fire service area. But the fire service will still respond, life safety, try to do that, and keep your house that's burning from igniting the woods and going over to burn your neighbor's house. The ambulance, the borough has in the city of Fairbanks, city of North Pole, run their first class cities. They run their ambulances and their fire departments. And the borough has an area wide, they call it ambulance service area. So no matter what, the ambulance will try to respond.
How's it paid for? Like, if the ambulance comes, are you paying out of pocket?
That's paid by an area-wide tax that applies to the... You live in the borough, but you don't live in the city. The city residents aren't paying. It's a service area.
So it's smaller. So the inside the city, you're paying a different level of tax than you are in the outside of the city.
Correct. You're paying. Well,
that reduced amount is your contribution to those emergency services.
I can't say. I don't know. Higher or lower. It's what's there.
Yeah.
And the assumption is if that service is so important to you, you will maintain your road. Somebody will. But it isn't somebody else's responsibility to do that.
Well, we are at time. If there's any other burning things that need to get resolved now. Excellent. So we will thank you for the conversation. Thank you for everyone for participating. As per usual, we have learned a lot more in community regional affairs that we ever thought that we needed to know. So with that, it concludes our business for today. We will set House Bill 379 aside. We will set an amendment deadline for the first bill we heard for House Bill 377 for Monday at noon. Next Tuesday, March 31st, we're already looking at the end of March, we'll be having an abbreviated meeting due to commitments. So we will send the rest of the schedule out by email. We've been getting some new requests in and some bills starting to come over from the other side and other committees. So with that... We will send you more information by email. With no further business before in the committee, the meeting is adjourned at 10:01 a.m.